Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. My guest on this month's General Talk is Lieutenant General Sir Barney Whitespanner, who is best described as a man of many parts. Commissioned into the Blues and Royals, following command of his regiment, his service was dominated by the struggles that overshadowed the world order at the turn of the century: the Balkans, Afghanistan and Iraq. Retiring as commander of the Field Army in 2012, Barney went on to chair the Countryside Alliance, the advisory board of UK Fisheries, and pursue a second and no less successful career as a best-selling author, having just published his fourth book, Berlin, The Story of a City. I'd like to start the military aspect of this interview. When you got appointed to command 16 Air Assault Brigade, having commanded the Household Cavalry Armoured Regiment, this was quite a change for you. You had to do P Company later in life, I think it's fair to say. How did you find the rigours of joining the Parachute Brigade as it was?
Well, it was a bit of a shock. It was a huge privilege and a huge pleasure. I actually did a quick sort of SAF pre-course before my jumps because there wasn't really a huge amount of time. We were already, by the time I arrived in Colchester, we were already looking to what might happen in the Republic of North Macedonia. And so almost no sooner had I arrived in Colchester than we were doing our recces and our preparation. And of course, we then deployed that summer to Skopje. Yeah. And 16 Assault Brigade formed the core of the multinational NATO brigade. And we had started that operation, disarm the Albanian National Liberation Army, and really gave some substance to the ORID talks, the Lake ORID agreement, which EU and NATO had negotiated. And interesting, actually, I'm still very involved in North Macedonia with George Robertson, Lord Robertson, who was then NATO Secretary General when I was running the operation on the ground. We formed a thing called the ORID Group together 2 years ago to help North Macedonia get into NATO, which is successfully done, and to get EU accession status, which again is, and we successfully done. So I go out there a lot, and Pranav Ali Akhmeti, who was the NLA leader, has become a very firm friend. He's an elder statesman of the Albanians in Skopje. And it's a great country.
You commanded the Household Cavalry Armoured Regiment in Bosnia in 1996. And obviously this is a long period of British Army involvement in the Balkans. How did you find the Northern Macedonians in comparison to the Bosnians and the Serbs and Serbo-Croats?
The North Macedonians, I think, they could benefit from having seen what could go wrong, what had happened in Croatia and in Bosnia particularly. I'm actually very fond of the Bosnians. I'm very fond of the Serbs. The Balkans is a great part of the world. It's part of the world with enormous potential at the moment. So I don't think I wouldn't want to sort of draw any sort of conclusions from ethnicity there. But I think it is because of the timing and because of the way that the political process sort of unfolded in North Macedonia. I think we had an opportunity because, as I say, they saw what could go wrong. An opportunity that actually arguably was denied to the Bosnians.
It was an exciting period to be in the army at the time, with first off starting with Bosnia and so on, and then on to Task Force Harvest. Did you name it Task Force Harvest? There's a little rural input there.
It was actually rather aptly named because we were there at harvest time in North Macedonia and we were harvesting these weapons. And it was actually the most satisfactory, fulfilling military mission to do because the NLA were largely up in the hills. And it's an incredibly beautiful country, that bit of the Balkans or the area of Europe. And it's very, very unspoiled. And they were right up in these sort of forests up on the hills, on the Albanian border and the Kosovo border. And we would go up and negotiate with them and talk to the various leaders. But every single time they made a commitment to bring their weapons in and to effectively disband, that's exactly what they did. We didn't have a single one who failed to honour their commitment. And I think that really surprised everybody in North Macedonia. It certainly surprised some of the sort of the Slav parties.
Or it was during your time in Macedonia that 9/11 took place. You then deployed as part of the Kabul Multinational Brigade in early 2002, as part of the American initial response to the Taliban. That must have been an exciting time to land in Kabul and then to roll through Afghanistan in the early days.
It was absolutely fascinating. And we went almost directly. I think we had about a month. So we had the brigade quite well tuned, if you like. I mean, we were quite ready. And it's a really good brigade, 16th Assault Brigade. It's a really coherent package of combat support, combat service support. It was well resourced. So yes, it was absolutely wonderful. I mean, it wasn't without its slightly alarming moments. The Taliban was still in Kabul, and we went into Bagram, and then rolled down into Kabul. But there was still quite a lot of tension, shall we say. It actually stabilised very quickly. The real problem we had in Kabul was actually getting the Afghans, the Kabulis, to realise actually what we were doing. Because, of course, Kabul was in a state of almost sort of medieval poverty by the time we got there, after the years of civil war and the Taliban. There was no effective television, there was no radio, no newspapers. And we'd arrived in Russian aeroplanes although people had come in hurt, all the kin that was coming in Antonov's hotel. So there was a lot of them thought we were the Russians come back. I have to say some of them weren't too upset because there's quite a lot of myths talked about the Russian occupation of Afghanistan, but certainly in Kabul, it wasn't quite as hated by everybody as has been made out. We got the message out through the mosques, in fact, through Friday prayers, and through actually a fascinating, information ops campaign that we ran, trying to explain who we were and what we were doing. And it actually stabilized remarkably quickly, and people could see that we were making a real difference. Of course, what then goes wrong in Afghanistan is it's not followed up. And I think that's one of the real sadnesses. I mean, I think the Rumsfeld diversion to Iraq was unfortunate. I think there was a real opportunity to have put something in place in Afghanistan then, but we took the West, took its finger off of the pulse. And Rumsfeld, remember, had this sort of Rumsfeld doctrine where the US didn't do nation building. The US military is there to go and sort of swap baddies and then somebody else figure out the pieces. Well, actually, that's totally unsustainable. And I think in the aftermath of 9/11, that was particularly unfortunate. But certainly it was a 16-hour assault brigade operation. Again, it was a multinational brigade. We had 16 different nations, I think, which was a command challenge. Enormously entertaining in many ways, sorting out different national aspirations, which wasn't always straightforward. But again, actually, from an extraordinary sort of 18-month period, from Macedonia to Kabul, it was a fantastic time to be commanding a brigade like 16-hour assault brigade.
5 years later, in 2007, you took over as GOC 3D in Bulford, and quite quickly after that, in February, you deployed as commander of the Multinational Division Southeast to Basra in Iraq. Do you feel that in some respects that you were deployed on an operation which you had no chance as a CD in?
The short answer is yes. I think the trouble about 2008 was it was abundantly clear that we were overstaying our welcome in Basra. We weren't achieving anything. And it was abundantly clear that we were there to keep the Americans happy. And actually said that directly to Gordon Brown when he used to come and see us. And it was true. I mean, we weren't too few of us to make any difference in Basra. The force had been withdrawn to Basra airfield, where it was sitting. With rockets being lobbed at it by the Jaish al-Mahdi, and actually not able to influence events on the ground. And we therefore concluded that the only thing we could do was to get the Iraqis themselves, we've been training up their army, to move into Basra. And that is eventually what happened. The timing went wrong. It was meant to happen in May. Maliki, who was the prime minister, actually kicked it off in April. And I wasn't actually there. I'd gone on early R&R because I wanted to get back for the planned operation at the end of May. Sooner had I left than I got telephone calls saying, I think you better come back. And it was an untidy and difficult time, but actually it stabilized quite quickly. And the Iraqis sort of established control because in a way the Brits were never going to be able to establish full control. We'd done our job getting in there. But quite why we had stayed that long rather beats me. And it actually interests me because I think as a nation, we're not very good at managing that political military interface.
You're putting a very diplomatic spin on it. Isn't it also fair to say that actually the division was deployed without the correct assets and resources to do its job? There was no chance of it doing its job. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, it's completely fair. I mean, I think there were under 2,000 of us and we were completely preoccupied with defending ourselves. So what on earth is the point of having, and I can say this actually, one, there's been a lot of loss and a lot of casualties in Iraq, and we should be always very conscious of that. So I'm talking about the end of this operation, when actually we had virtually stopped taking casualties, not completely. And we were, exactly as you say, we were there as a sort of for a political move, because nobody wanted to stand up to the Americans and say, actually, we've done a job, we're getting out. And it's a classic example of actually, you know, very bad political military coordination. I think the Ministry of Defence for time has a lot to answer for that, in that we actually just were sort of almost, we described ourselves as a tethered goat, and, you know, you can't bluff soldiers. So going around and chatting to boys on the airfield as rockets were sort of lobbed in on us, you know, there was quite a lot of sort of quizzical faces from from British soldiers.
It comes down to the fact that the poor British Tommy will do what he's told, and he'll do his very best. Given the kit, he can win the world. Is it not similar to, you talked earlier, to the fact that in Afghanistan, had we had the resources, we could have succeeded? You're not the only general to have said that. Do you not feel, therefore, that again, in Afghanistan, had the British Army been deployed with the right assets, we could have succeeded there?
Well, I think, you know, I'm a great fan of the Americans in many ways, but I think there is a slight naivety at the top of the British sort of foreign military sort of setup, who still believes in a special relationship. There isn't a special relationship. There are times when American national interests and British national interests coincide, but they're few and far between. And I think there is, certainly of that government, there was a certain naivety. And I think Gordon Brown, I think he was badly advised. And there was almost a sort of blind, well, the Americans are doing it, the Americans have asked for it, so we've got to do it. But there was no separate analysis of whether it was in our interest to do it. It wasn't, you know, in our interest to stay in Iraq. It may well have been to go in at the beginning, which was, as we all know, successful, very successfully managed operation by Robin Brims. But the, and again, go back to Afghanistan, actually it would be much more in our interest, arguably, to have done something more permanent there. The other thing which was really, I think, ill-advised was to try and do two major operations like that at the same time. And I was chief of staff at Land Command at the time. So actually it was my job to try and find the troops and the kit, the vehicles, the helicopters, because Joint Helicopter Command was then under us. And we just, as a military, we weren't set up to do it. I was part of a defence policy team that wrote the strategic defence and security review for George Robertson in 1997. It's the first time I worked for him. And, it was entirely based on doing one, if you like, major medium-scale operation at a time. So to try and think we could do two, just because, you know, there was this sort of rather vague notion of a special relationship, I think is very strange.
It's interesting. But the question one has to ask is, why then do we keep saying, yes, 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 we can do it, when obviously we can't?
Well, I think we can do, what is really important to this process is that you work out what you've got the resources to do and you do that. But what senior military people should do is to stand up when there is a political desire to do more than we are actually resourced to do. So actually what we were doing was doing two operations badly rather than one well. And I have to say that actually once we came out of Iraq, thank God, in 2009, arguably several years too late, actually the effort and the what we did in Helmand was much better resourced. And Land Command did, I was Commander of Field Army at that time, we were able and we were well supported in doing thing called Op Entirety, where actually we didn't say we're really an army that's meant to be fighting in Europe, but actually we'll just do this as a sort of a sideshow. We actually turned the core of the army into supporting Helmand, and actually Helmand didn't work for various reasons, but it wasn't actually, but the British army was badly equipped in the end. It was at the beginning, as we sadly know. But by the end, it was well equipped. And it actually was the beginning of our sort of proper digital facilitation of the British Armed Forces, I should say. So I think that Op Entirety actually teaches us a lesson. And I rather wish that we should have done that at the beginning of Iraq.
Of course, sadly, with time marching on, that lesson will probably be forgotten. And the fellow who takes the brunt of it is always going to be the soldier on the ground. But I'd like to go back to your time as commander of the Field Army. The army you joined in 1979 was very different. What do you think of the army you left and the army today?
I love the British Army, and I think it is a wonderful organisation. I think it is very misunderstood by a lot of people. And its strength, to me, is its sort of elasticity, if you like. It's fact that it's able, it's a broad church, it's able to change quickly, it's able to adapt, it's able to bring in different skill sets. What do I think about it? I think it's an army now that doesn't make as good use of the reserves as it could do. And I think as we look at the future, so much, we get back to what I was saying about elasticity, being able to adapt and incorporate. There are so many skills you can't hold full time in a small army like ours, because A, we can't afford them, and B, people get bored because they won't be used. The way we do the medics, I think, is almost a classic model of how we should do the reserves. And that, to me, is something we've got absolutely right. So we have a small, full-time regular corps, and then we bring in the civilian experts, we bring in the consultants from the big NHS hospitals for a short period as we need them. It gives them experience of operations, and it gives us absolutely top-class medics. And the last thing the world the army would want to do now would be to have 152 sort of specialist surgical teams, which I think is what you get in a big NHS hospital, something like that. We just couldn't employ them in peacetime, so you bring them when you need them. Now that principle should be applied much more widely, I think, to linguists on the intelligence side, on the particularly as we get into the cyber and space side. So I think that is if we don't do that as well, I think, having said that, we are a much more active professional army than we were. When I joined, I spent my first few years in Germany. It was actually a very sort of well-tuned animal, but there is no doubt that we were lacking combat experience. And although we were organizationally sort of structured, we were quite wooden in our thinking. So it was structurally very good, but it was combat, it was weak in experience. There is nothing really to compensate for that operational experience. I've been incredibly fortunate in my military career to have seen a bit. We're still the same people. I mean, I wrote about Waterloo. The soldiers in today's army are the same soldiers who signed up in 1815.
This is almost an interview of two halves, because concurrent to a very successful military career, you also had a career as a journalist, shall we say, because you managed to be the hunting correspondent of the field and also editor of Bailey's Hunting Directory. How did you manage to hold that down with a busy military life? What's the secret?
Well, I didn't when I got busy in the army. I had to stop it. I did it, because I enjoyed writing, and it gave me an opportunity to do it. And I used to go off at sort of weekends it was only about sort of half dozen days a year. But it was a wonderful experience. And the field was a wonderful organization. And hunting's always been a sort of very major part of my life. So it sort of put all that together. But there is no doubt that experience actually got me into into writing.
In the 14th century, the Duke of Burgundy wrote that the fourth code of chivalry was that of sagacity. And of course, you are as a soldier and now as an author. In 2006, you wrote Horse Guards, which was the first major history of the Life Guards, the Blues and the Royals ever written. 608 pages is a bit of a doorstop. But tell me, that was a huge research task. All your books are huge research tasks. How do you go about preparing for these enormous written tomes?
I've been very lucky so far in that I can write about things that I've experienced or are huge interesting to me. So I haven't yet had to approach a subject cold, and I'm not actually certain how easy it is to approach a subject completely cold. So House of Cavalry, I'd spent my life in, and I think I understood a bit. When I wrote about Waterloo, I mean, that was an extension of the House of Cavalry bits. I'd spent a long time on Waterloo writing the Horse Guards book. India was rarely came directly as a result of partition, came directly as a result of experience in Iraq. And also, I'd spent a long time in India as a student, and I knew India well, and Pakistan. And then Berlin. Yeah, you know, I spent many years in my early days in the army, and spent a long time in Berlin.
Du bist nicht ein Berliner. So what is your qualification to write this book about Berlin? And did you find that the Berliners themselves were rather questioning as to why a rather lovely old British general wants to come and write about their city?
I love being described as a lovely old British general. No, not at all, because one's writing for, well, three things. Berliners are fed up with books about the Second World War, as I say in that. They were longing for somebody to take a view of Berlin's history as a whole. And that book starts in 1237 and it goes all the way through. Secondly, it is a book written rarely, like, for the English market. And it's rarely for English and American, and actually interestingly Chinese. It's for the many visitors who go to Berlin, who want to get under the sort of skin of a city and don't want to be endlessly filled with stuff about the Nazis or the Cold War. But thirdly, your point's an interesting one, because it presupposes that you sort of have to be a native of somewhere to write about it. And I don't think that's right. Particularly somewhere like Berlin, where I'd spent an awful lot of time, but actually to write as a Berliner, I mean, could I write a biography of London? I think I'd find it very difficult to write a biography of London.
I suppose that most people nowadays think of Berlin, that their first thoughts would be of cabaret, the Berlin, the liberal Berlin of the 1920s, when it was the hub of Europe. But what before that period is your favourite golden era of Berlin itself?
Gosh, it's such an interesting question. I mean, I think it has rarely to be the end of the 18th century. So probably from the death of Frederick the Great in the 1780s through until the expulsion of the French in 1814. People forget that there was a six-year, very bitter French occupation. But why do I choose that period? Because it's the time when Berlin actually becomes the capital of Germany, in inverted commas, because obviously Germany didn't exist then. But it becomes the city which begins to sort of be the aspiration of a German nationalist movement as a centre of that aspiration. So you have Frederick the Great sitting with his sort of Frenchified, really very old-fashioned, stilted court out at Potsdam. Actually, what's going on in Berlin, and Berlin doubles in size during Frederick the Great's reign, you are finding a real expression of Germanness, of German architectural expression, which you've got the Brandenburg Gate by Langhans, you have the extraordinarily talented Schinkel, who not only designs the Iron Cross, but designs so many wonderful buildings, actually to whom Berlin really owes so much.
I mean, you knew the divided Germany from your own service side. How do you think Germany as a nation is now? Has it made up that imbalance, that what we might call the North-South divide, as it were?
Yeah, it's a million-dollar question. One of the things I actually say in the book is that the Berlin as a city is a model to which I think Germany as a nation aspires. One of the interesting things about Berlin is how incredibly multinational it has always been. And it's always been a city of immigrants. And people make, it was never a Prussian city. It was the capital of Prussia, but it was never Prussian in that sense. It's always been full of immigrants from all over the place, even more so now. And it's one of the things which is so attractive about Berlin is that it's integrated all those different immigrant communities incredibly well, even in its extraordinary accent. And you know, it's Berlinerish, its sort of local dialect, which is you sadly hardly hear anymore. But over the centuries, you know, it incorporated French, Yiddish, Southern German, Saxon, Russian words. And it's just an example of how extraordinarily inclusive a society it is. And they talk about typical Berliners. There's no such thing as a typical Berliner. And a wonderful German academic and friend, Christoph Stürzel, said to me as I was writing the book, he said, a typical Berliner is somebody who's just arrived at the railway station. So actually, when you look at German history and this sort of age-old debate as did the Romans colonize east of the Elbe, answer to which is almost certainly not, you know, this sort of split between the east and the west, Berlin's always been really more as much an eastern city as a western one. And it's also been this sort of magnet for immigrants. So to me, actually, what it is now is very much a model for the modern German, even though it's stuck in the middle of Brandenburg, where off to the east.
I'd like to just bring it up to the present day. In researching the book, you must have obviously gone to Berlin a lot. Where for you is your favorite part of the city?
Gosh, I absolutely love. I love the centre and what they've done to the centre. And one of the things which is so endearing about Berlin is it doesn't hide its history. It wears its history on its sleeve, if you like. So you look at the rebuilt Berliner Schloss, the Royal Palace, if you like, in the middle. It's been designed, rebuilt as the original, which was destroyed by Ulbricht in 1950. On three sides, and then the last side is modern, which faces east, and it has a completely modern facade. And it's actually incredibly effective. So in the center of the city, you've actually got a building which brings east and west together. And it looks out over the Lustgarten and that incredible collection of museums. So that inevitably has to be, and that top bit of Unter den Linden with the armory and the Babelplatz, as it's called, where they did the book, Nazis did the book burning, which used to be the Forum Friedrichanum, with the Frederick the Great's Forum on the Humboldt University. I mean, that's one of the most beautiful areas now as a city centre, and it's taken a long time to get it back after 1945.
Berlin after the Second World War was a city divided for nearly 50 years. And I specifically would like to just inveigle your assistance, if I may, because at this moment, it is fortuitous you're on the programme, because the Soldiers' Charity are running a fundraiser this Christmas called Operation Bletchley, Christmas in Berlin, which is set at the time of the Berlin airlift and the Berlin blockade. Can you describe to us the situation in 1948 when the Russians or the Soviet Union decided to take matters into their own hands with regard to the Allies?
I always believe that Stalin must have regretted his agreement at Yalta to partition Berlin. And so when Stalin had the opportunity to take Berlin, I think he couldn't really believe that he was going to get the lair of the fascist beast, if you like, this sort of ultimate symbol of revenge on what the Nazis had done to Russia. But he stuck to it. And so despite in May 1945, after the Russians took Berlin, them prevaricating for several months before they let the Allies into the city, they did duly let the Allies in. And by July, there was a major Allied victory parade and the city was split into three, Russian, British and American. And we then gave two bits of the British sector were given to the French in the northwest. But it obviously became clear to Stalin that this was a very uncomfortable position. And I think he genuinely either had miscalculated or he hadn't sort of realized just what a sort of eyesore, if you like, to his good communist state that he had sent Ulbricht back to create, having the Western allies in Berlin was going to be. And actually the Western allies, Americans, were very clever about it, because by putting a sort of brigade-sized forces there, any move against them would be a declaration of war, but they couldn't be seen as a serious threat. So he was slightly outplayed. And I think what really pushed him into trying to get rid of the Allies was in 1948, when he realized that economically he was not going to be able to compete, East Berlin couldn't compete with the West. And that was really brought about by the introduction of a Deutschmark. Because after the war, there had been a sort of allied sort of standing currency, if you like. The real currency actually was cigarettes for about 2 years in Berlin. But in June 1948, the Americans and with the West Germans bought in the Deutschmark. And with the coming of Deutschmark, which was issued in Berlin as well in June 1948, it became abundantly clear that, if you like, that economic link, if you like, the umbilical cord to the West was there. And if you're Stalin, you don't really want to risk another war. I mean, Russia was exhausted. I don't think he necessarily thought he'd win it. So he reverts to this idea of trying to sort of force the Allies out by starving the city. One of the agreements made at Yalta, then confirmed at Potsdam, was these corridors in, air and land corridors. And what he does is shut off the land corridors in June 1948, and they stay shut until May 1949.
There was, of course, only one way to break the 318-day Soviet blockade of the road and rail corridors, and that was by flying in supplies to keep the city alive, which the Americans named Operation Vittles and we Operation Plainfare, but collectively was known as the Berlin Airlift.
What is quite extraordinary is the effort that goes into the airlift. And why it's really sort of heartening in some ways is, of course, these pilots who now resupply Berlin, and of whom 39 British and 31 Americans lose their lives. These are the same people who've been bombing Berlin only a couple of years before. And it's an extraordinary effort, 277,804 flights over a space of nearly 11 months.
Colonel Gail Halverson, affectionately known as the Candy Bomber of the United States Air Force.
We flew everything. I mean, medical supplies, newsprint, but the coal was the biggest thing, and it was the biggest problem, too. The coal dust would seep in the floors and the control cables, make it difficult to control the airplane. So we flew with our escape hatches out in the back to suck out the dust.
Big EZ-64, I have you in contact over the Tempelhof range. If you'll pick up a heading now to get you over. Planner Big is coming down very nice. Now you're starting to go a little bit above your glide path.
And the other thing which makes it remarkable, of course, that there was only one rarely usable airport, which was Tempelhof. The British had a sort of little airstrip at Gatow across the harbour, but it wasn't really a sort of proper airport. And so a new airport is built in the French sector called Tegel, which is the only one up until very recently has been the main civilian airport for Berlin. And it's in the French sector, and the French the French helped hugely building it, although the French government won't actually participate in the airlift. But what's so remarkable about it is it sort of cements, helped by the great Reuter, Julius Reuter, who's the mayor of West Berlin. Berlin has suddenly stopped being these awful sort of Nazi sympathizers, which of course they never were. Berlin was the most un-Nazi city in Germany. And they become the heroes on the front line against communism. And it does a huge amount, the Airlift, to bring modern Germany, modern West Germany, into the Western family of nations. It's quite extraordinary how that sort of suffering brings people together. And by far the most popular radio program that Christmas in 1948 is a thing called Die Insulaner, which is broadcast by the American radio in the American sector, basically the American Forces radio. And it's listened to, it has staggering listening figures, something about 80% of Berliners listen to it, including in the East, which was illegal.
Der Insulaner verliert die Ruhe nicht. Der Insulaner liebt kein Getue nicht. Und brummt es nachts auch laut, schwärme. Das ist Musik.
Günter Neumann's Die Insulaner, performed in December 1948.
You talk of Berlin then being on the front line against communism. The city had been flattened, and my understanding is flattened would be an understatement. In 1945, at the end of hostilities by the invading army, specifically of Russia or the Soviet Union. At Christmas at that time of year, 1948, very cold Christmas, what would the scene be like? And
it's pretty grim. A lot of people are sleeping in rooms without walls, literally. Particularly in the centre. Some bits of the west, of course, haven't been affected because they weren't fought over, and actually some bits of the east weren't. So some areas of Charlottenburg and that haven't been too badly affected, but certainly the centre has. It's very quiet. And the great thing that people always remember about Berlin was for noise, for chatter, and it's there now. Berlin is an endlessly busy city. People who knew it before the war, then saw it over that winter, said how it's one thing you rarely noticed. There was very little traffic, there was very little fuel, there was very little light, there was very little power, because the power stations, the ones in the west, had been dismantled by the Russians. The main power stations had been in the east, and there was no coal. There was very little food. But there was a huge outpouring of, if you like, city spirit. So in the elections that take place that winter for Reuter, there was a huge turnout, you know, when people have got lots of other things on their minds. When there is a public rally in front of the Reichstag, it is attended by tens of thousands of people. It is a sort of coming together in that sort of West Berlin spirit. And one of the things that interests me in the book is that sort of spirit has always been there in Berlin. And it's when you get an immigrant population and you put them together in a city and they identify with the city and with what that city represents, then something like when the face of adversity, like the airlift, you get this very strong spirit, and people remember it well, and they remember huge gratitude to the Allies. And I think a lot of them said, "Why should the Allies do that for us after what?" You know.
As Britain leaves the European Union, do you think that Berlin will become ascendant again?
Well, I think it's pretty ascendant now. To be honest, I think. I don't think you get much more ascendant. It is, you could argue, as much a political capital of Europe as Paris, and probably more so than Brussels in terms of influence. But it is an ascendant city. But I think I go back to this point that if Germany is looking for a model as a nation to continue to bridge east and west, to continue to welcome immigrants, Berlin is that model. Berlin, and the way Berlin has developed and the way it works now, is to my mind sort of what Germany aspires to. What I think the real problem Berlin has at the moment is it's getting too gentrified, it's getting too expensive. Because it's such a thoroughly nice place to live, and it is, it's a fantastic place, it's got these wonderful open spaces, it's got fantastic culture, it's got the politics, it's got really wonderful countryside around it. It's pretty easy, very easy to get around. But the what's happened is so many Germans, it's become much, much more like London and Paris, in that a lot of rich Germans are now getting second homes there. And actually a lot of Brits too. I mean, it was a very big rich expat population. So you've still got the immigrants coming in, and the Berliners have been very welcoming to Syrians and refugees from the Middle East, despite what the media would tell you. But so you've got them sort of trying to find cheap housing, yet you've got the price of housing being forced higher and higher by these rather rich Germans and Europeans getting either going to live there or getting second homes there. I think the biggest threat to Berlin at the moment is that, because it would be, it's still got that wonderful traditional rough around the edges feeling. You still get that frontier feel. You still get that sort of feeling of fear, of tension, fear, real excitement. And it's always been there. And it's fueled by, I'd say, by the immigration. But if it is going to become very gentrified and very sort of almost sort of Biedermeier-esque again, then I think there is, it would be a pity. But it is certainly, I would argue, it's the second most visited city in Europe now after London.
2006, you started with Horse Guards. We went at 2015 to Waterloo. Then we had Partition, now Berlin. What's next on the White Spanner horizon?
I've got lots of ideas, Harry. Knocking around. I haven't actually decided yet. I'm deep in discussion. But let's see how Berlin goes down. Let's see whether people want to keep reading what I write.
Thank you so much for being my guest on General Talk today. I think that it is rare that we have a guest who is able to talk of a career in two halves. And it is fantastic to see that as an author, you're motoring on to the great uplands. So thank you so much again for being my guest.
Berlin, The Story of a City by Barney Weitzbanner is published by Simon & Schuster, price £25. Copies of which can also be won as part of Operation Bletchley Christmas in Berlin, the award-winning virtual code-breaking challenge run by ABF The Soldiers Charity, which has raised over £140,000 for our soldiers and veterans this year alone. Christmas in Berlin, which starts on Boxing Day, is open to anyone, any age, anywhere in the world. It is, I am told, a wonderful way to burn off those festive excesses while exercising your grey matter at the same time. It costs £10 to take part, and to sign up or to gift a sign up to a friend or relative, visit soldierscharity.org/Operation Bletchley.
If you'd like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers Charity, please visit thesoldierscharity.org. With editing by Michael Stigliano, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity. Ta-da! Thank you.